The following is a presentation of VBR. Welcome, and thank you for joining us in our study of God's Holy Word.
Continuing in the video Bible reading of the book of Acts, session number 18, picking up the storyline in Acts chapter 6, we've had the appointment of seven men to take care of the serving of the tables, the waiting of tables for the church, taking care of the needs of the widows and other needy persons among them, so that there would be no needy persons among them. One man is especially singled out in the list of the seven who were chosen, and that man was named Stephen, and he is described as a man full of wisdom, full of the Holy Spirit, full of faith, full of grace, and again, full of the Spirit, full of grace and power in Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. And that's where we are at this moment in this series of studies, is Acts chapter 6, verses 8 through 15. Stephen had been doing signs and wonders among the people. And prior to this, only the apostles had been doing signs and wonders. But the Spirit is now at work in Stephen after the apostles had laid hands on him and the other six. And some of those who belong to the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called, that name, the Synagogue of the Freedmen, is understood to mean that it was at least founded by, not necessarily that every member of that synagogue. And by the way, the word synagogue, like the word church, basically means an assembly of people. The synagogue, the assembly of the freedmen. The original founders of that synagogue probably were Jews who had won their freedom, purchased their freedom out in the Greek-speaking world, and then had come to Jerusalem, transplants to Jerusalem. And the groups of people that are mentioned here, the Synagogue of the Freedmen, some are Cyrenians, Alexandrians, those from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and disputed with Stephen. So as Stephen is now preaching in the synagogue, at least this one synagogue, maybe the very synagogue he had previously been a member of before he became a disciple of Christ, but at least people with whom he shared some Greek-speaking heritage, there's opposition here. There's people who don't like his message, don't agree with his message, and they are in opposition to him, disputing with Stephen. Now, these Hellenistic, the freedmen, again, implies Hellenistic or Greek-speaking Jews of the diaspora, had joined together in Jerusalem, and we have Cyrenians and Alexandrians are mentioned here, which would be from North Africa, Libya and Egypt. Cyrene is in Libya, and Alexandria is in Egypt. Cilicia and Asia, in terms of the modern map, those are regions of Turkey. Cilicia over in the western part and, Cilicia down in the southeastern part, and Asia being in the western area over toward the west coast of Turkey. Cilicia is the region where the leading city of Cilicia was a city called Tarsus. And Tarsus was the hometown of a man named Saul, who was also called Paul. And Saul, was probably involved in these disputes with Stephen. He's about to come into the story at the end of chapter 7 by name. But since he is from Cilicia, and since he was involved in the trial and stoning of Stephen that we're about to read about in the 7th chapter, it's very likely that Paul was involved in the disputes that were going on here between Stephen and these men from Libya, from Cyrene, from Alexandria, from Cilicia, from Asia. Paul, in Acts chapter 21, verse 39, Paul says, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." So we know that this is where Paul came from. And again, he's about to turn up in the story here toward the end of the 7th chapter of Acts. They rose up, the account says, they rose up and disputed with Stephen, as the Pharisees and others had done during the ministry of Jesus. Mark chapter 8, verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to argue with Jesus, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. The signs he was doing weren't good enough. The signs Stephen was doing weren't good enough. There will always be those for whom no kind of evidence is good enough. And so they disputed with him. Verse 10, Acts chapter 6, verse 10, but they could not withstand the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. They're arguing, they're disputing, but they're not winning. They're not successful. They're not carrying the day. They cannot resist. They cannot withstand the wisdom of Stephen's word and the spirit that stands behind his message. This is consistent with what Jesus had promised his disciples. Luke chapter 21, verse 15, when Jesus was talking about the coming troubles that they would face as his disciples, he said in Luke 21, 15, "I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict." What Jesus had promised his disciples then is now true in terms of Stephen. His opponents could not successfully withstand his arguments, but they also refused to accept his arguments or agree with what he was teaching. And that refusal could only lead to trouble. So verse 11, Acts 6, verse 11, "Then they secretly instigated men who said, 'We've heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God.'" They instigated men, hupobalo, to introduce underhandedly. This is a plot, a conspiracy to undermine Stephen, to make a secret agreement to suborn, to put forward by collusion, to suborn in the legal sense, to induce a person to make a false oath. So they've left the track of honesty here. They are, in fact, guilty of violating the commandment that said, "You shall not bear false witness." In order to accomplish their aim of preserving what they believe an appropriate form of Judaism to be, they're willing to violate the basic commands of Judaism, the Ten Commandments. They're willing to violate the command against false testimony in the Ten Commandments. They accuse Stephen of speaking blasphemous words, speaking evil, saying slanderous, reproachful things about Moses. Not sure that's really something that is reasonable in a context of an accusation of blasphemy, but against Moses and against God. And Stephen would not be guilty actually of either of those things, although he said things that maybe could be distorted and twisted in that direction, as we're going to see. Verse 12, Acts chapter 6, verse 12, "And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council." So now this is the third time that a disciple of Jesus is standing before the Jewish council. The first time it was Peter and John in Acts chapter 4. The second time it was all 12 apostles in Acts chapter 5. And now in Acts chapter 6, it's Stephen who's standing before the Jewish council. He's standing where Jesus himself once stood. He's standing where Peter and John stood. He's standing where the 12 had stood before him. In verse 13, Acts 6, 13, "They set up false witnesses who said, 'This man never ceases to speak words against this holy place,'" in other words, the temple, "'and the law, for we have heard him say, this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses delivered to us.'" So this again is very much like what happened to Jesus. We can see the parallels very clearly. Matthew chapter 26, verses 59 through 61, when Jesus was brought to trial before the Sanhedrin, "The chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. And they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. And at last two came forward and said, 'This man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" Now that's a distortion of what he said. What he did say over in John chapter 2 and verse 20 was, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days." And we're told that he meant by that the temple of his body. But they said, Jesus had said, "I am able to destroy this temple and rebuild it in 3 days." Well, if that wasn't true, then it was just lunacy. If a man would say things like that, it's not something that would be worthy of a condemnation for blasphemy and a death penalty in any case. The same distortion, though, is going on previously with Jesus, and here in the story, the same distortion is going on with Stephen. There was not a claim made that Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place. That wasn't the claim. However, there was a claim that that temple would be destroyed when the abomination of desolation came on the scene. The temple would be destroyed, Jesus prophesied. And there certainly was a prophecy that Jesus has made that if his body, the true temple of God, were destroyed, he would raise it up again in 3 days. But the accusations here are twisted and distortions, and they're purposefully distorted. That's clear in the context here that these are people who are purposefully distorting both the teachings of Jesus when he was on trial and now the teachings of Stephen as he stands before the Sanhedrin. The preaching of the new covenant, the new temple, the fulfillment of sacrifice and offerings in Christ, no doubt Stephen had been proclaiming these things, the good news of Jesus, in ways that they could not refute, that God had brought about the new covenant, the new temple, the new form of worship, worship in spirit and in truth. But since they couldn't refute his teaching, they couldn't refute his interpretation of prophecy, they couldn't refute the eyewitness testimony, they couldn't refute the empty tomb and the fact that Jesus had ascended into heaven. So instead, they took sound bites and then they distorted those sound bites into a message of subversion, that he is undermining the Jewish people and the authority of the leaders. This same twisting still happens. It's a false dichotomy that's pictured here between Moses and Christ, between the law and its fulfillment. And Jesus had fulfilled the law. Acts chapter 6, verse 15, gazing at him, all who sat in the council saw that his face was like the face of an angel. Gazing. They're looking intently at Stephen. Their attention is fixed on Stephen. And Luke describes his appearance, his face being like the face of an angel. And I'm not 100% sure exactly what that means. I doubt if he means that his face was radiant or that he had a halo, because those kinds of descriptions don't seem at all appropriate to the circumstances, nor consistent with the appearance of angels in various times and places. But I suppose that Luke is referring here to Stephen's radiant confidence. He absolutely here is in the faith. He is trusting God. He is not a man who's plagued by guilt and fear. He has utter confidence as he stands before the Sanhedrin. He has serenity. He is at peace in this moment in his life, despite the accusations, false distortions being made against him. But he was at peace in the Lord. And so Acts chapter 7, verse 1, and the high priest said, "Are these things so?" The things that have been brought against him as charges, these scurrilous charges of blasphemy against Moses and God, against the law, against the holy place. Have you done that? After the high priest asked his question, Stephen then began to speak. And Acts chapter 7, verses 2 through 53, is the substance of Stephen's answer, and then we have the aftermath from what Stephen said. His defense of what he had been teaching. Not really a defense of himself, per se, to try and avoid prosecution, but a defense of the message, a defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have an overview in Stephen's message here of the patriarchs and Abraham, of the patriarchs of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, the 12 sons of Jacob. They have the sojourn of the family of Israel in Egypt. We have the work of Moses, the Exodus, the transformation from family into nation, the idolatry of Israel, the tabernacle and the temple, and ultimately the conclusion that God has provided a greater and more sufficient answer in the person and the work of Jesus, the righteous one. That none of those things were God's final answer. But now in Jesus Christ, we have the totality, the completion of what God had been doing all through those previous 2,000 years of history. Looking at Stephen's answer in thematic chunks, let's start here in Acts chapter 7 and verses 1 through 8. The high priest said, "Are these things so?" And Stephen said, "Brothers and fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Go out from your land and from your kindred and go into the land that I will show you.' Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran. And after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. Yet he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot's length, but promised to give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him, though he, Abraham, had no child. And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and afflict them 400 years. But I will judge the nation they serve, said God, and after that they shall come out and worship me in this place, the land of Canaan. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs." So Stephen began with respectful language. Are these things true? He began respectfully, "Brothers and fathers," speaking to this crowd gathered in hostility against him. He continues and he says, "The God of glory." Now that's a term from Psalm 29 and verse 3. Psalm 29 verse 3 celebrates God's power over everything in the world. It's a reminder of the way God has manifested his presence to Israel in the wilderness at Sinai when his glory appeared in the cloud and in the tent of meeting. When God rescued Israel from Egypt, the glory of God appeared in the cloud. It stood between the armies of Egypt and the Israelite people. When they crossed the Red Sea, the glory of God was evident in the cloud that was over their heads, accompanying them as they made that transit. When they were in the wilderness, that cloud, the glory of God, was visible day after day after day. When the tabernacle was consecrated, the glory of God appeared in the tabernacle. The God of glory. Stephen is connecting here in this reference to the God of glory and what he's done. He's tying together all of these episodes in the Old Testament. He begins his defense of the faith with Abraham. While Abraham was still in Ur of the Chaldeans, when he was still living among the pagan culture of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, Genesis chapter 11, verses 27 and 28, God revealed himself to Abraham in Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. In modern terms, we're talking about the region of Iraq. And in Haran, and Haran is in northeastern Syria, where those ancient nations come together. In Haran, and then in this land where you are now living. He mentions these things in chapter 7, verse 2, verse 3, and verse 4. God spoke to him when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran. God spoke to him when he was in Haran before he went to Canaan. And then when he went out and after his father died, God sent him into this land where you are now living. So God dealt with Abraham when he was in Ur of the Chaldees. And God dealt with Abraham when he was in Haran in Aramea or the area of modern Syria. And God dealt with Abraham when he was in Canaan, which became the land of Israel. God wasn't bound to any location. This is pertinent to the accusation. Stephen has spoken against this holy place. And Stephen's saying, well, God dealt with Abraham there, and he dealt with Abraham there, and he dealt with Abraham there. God dealt with Abraham in all of these places. Our forefathers came out of Ur of the Chaldees, came out of Haran, came into Canaan. Abraham didn't own any of it, but God dealt with Abraham in Canaan. God isn't bound to any location, nor are those who serve God bound to any location. He continues, he talks about God's promises to Abraham. Even before he had a child, there was a process to fulfill the promises, the covenant commitments. There were changes in location, changes in circumstance. God appeared to him. He didn't give him an inheritance, not even a foot's length, but he promised to give him the possession for his offspring, to give to him as a possession to his offspring after him, even though God said all these things up through Genesis chapters 12, 13, 14, 15. God says these things to Abraham. Up to that time, Abraham still has no child. And when Abraham finally becomes impatient along with plotting with his wife Sarai, and they produce a child from a slave, that still isn't God's answer. God's answer doesn't come until Abraham is 100 years old when his son Isaac is born. But all of these circumstances, there are changes in location, changes in circumstance, and a passage of time in order to achieve the purposes of God. In fact, as he talks about what God did and when and where God did it, he says it was going to be 400 years, and that comes from the end of the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis. Genesis 15, God appeared to Abraham in a visionary way, and he told him that his descendants would be in a land not their own, that is to say Egypt, and they would be there, and after 400 years they would come out, that during their time in Egypt they would be mistreated and enslaved, and after 400 years they would come out. And so God was working all these things out, but he made a promise to Abraham that his descendants would worship God in this place. That's Acts chapter 7, verse 7 here. I will judge the nation they serve, said God, and after that they shall come out and worship me in this place. But when God said that to Abraham, Abraham was not in Jerusalem. He was in Canaan, but he was not in Jerusalem. And so this place is much broader than Jerusalem itself. A future place of worship was envisioned. Abraham had no place of worship to speak of. Wherever Abraham went, he would erect an altar to God and he would call on the name of the Lord. He had no temple. He had no structure, no specific location to which he would go to worship God. There was a future place of worship envisioned here, but Abraham received none of the land. He had no sacred temple in which to worship God, and neither did his son. Neither did his grandsons or his great-grandsons. None of them had this structure, this place to worship God in what was then the land of Canaan. As Paul would later stress in his letter to the Galatians, particularly chapters 3 and 4, the covenant sign of circumcision came after Abraham obeyed God. Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. And after that, we have God giving Abraham the covenant of circumcision, the covenant sign of circumcision. The believing God and being credited with righteousness is in the 15th chapter of Genesis. The sign of circumcision is in the 17th chapter of Genesis. So the covenant and the promises had already been made before the covenant sign of circumcision was given for Abraham and all his male offsprings. The 12 patriarchs that are mentioned here by Stephen, Jacob and the 12 patriarchs in verse 8, that is to say the 12 sons of Jacob, these were the forefathers. That's what the term patriarch means. It means a forefather. It means an ancestral father. The patriarchs were the forefathers of the people of Israel. And all of these people had served God according to the knowledge that they had in the land of Canaan and eventually in Egypt and then in the wilderness and then again in Egypt. And none of them had had this holy place that Stephen was being accused of speaking against. He speaks against Moses. Abraham didn't know Moses. Abraham followed God long before Moses. He speaks against this holy place, and none of these people had that holy place. Acts chapter 7, continuing Stephen's word here, Acts chapter 7, verses 9 through 16, and the patriarchs, those 12 sons of Jacob, well, 10 of them, 10 of those 12 sons of Jacob, the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. But God was with him and rescued him from all of his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him ruler over Egypt and over all his household. Now there came a famine throughout all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers could find no food. And when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent our fathers on their first visit. And on the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and summoned Jacob, his father, and all his kindred, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down to Egypt, and he died, and our fathers, and they were carried back to Shechem, and laid in the tomb that Abraham had bought for a sum of silver from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. Now Joseph is a paradigm of Jesus, a type and a shadow, a prophetic foreshadowing of Jesus. He is a paradigm of Jesus. He is a foreshadowing. He was rejected by his brothers, but he was rescued from his afflictions by God. Stephen certainly has that in mind as he lays this out as a frame of reference. This is what happened to Joseph. And these people knew. They certainly would have seen that Stephen was making a connection to the idea of how Jesus had been treated. Rejected by his peers, by his brothers, but rescued from his afflictions by God. This is what Peter had been preaching. This is what Peter and John had proclaimed in front of the Sanhedrin on occasion when they had been in that situation. And Joseph was given favor or grace and wisdom, and he ruled the land and the household. And so also God has given grace, favor, and wisdom to Jesus, and he rules over the household and the land. He rules over the kingdom of God. Stephen here makes reference to the first and second visits that Jacob's family made to Egypt. And this may be an allusion, I think, in terms of what Stephen's talking about. There may be an allusion here to the coming of the Christ. He came once for salvation, and he comes again when every eye will see him and know him when he appears the second time, and that is for all his people to be gathered together as one family in one place. But whether Stephen had a prophetic foreshadowing in mind or not, historically the patriarchs, Jacob and his sons, all died in Egypt, far from the promised land. Jacob's body was embalmed in Egypt over a period of many days and then transported back to Canaan for burial under the authority of Joseph, who was still alive and still the governor in Egypt. In the same cave, Jacob was buried in the same cave where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob's wife Leah had been buried. And then after 400 years, as prophesied to Abraham, after 400 years when the Exodus occurred, as recorded in the book of Exodus, Joseph's body, as Joseph requested on his deathbed, he requested that his body be transported back to Canaan for burial. When his family left Egypt, according to the promises of God, so when the Exodus occurred, They, in fact, took Joseph's bones with them. The coffin with Joseph's bones in it was carried out of Egypt and back to Canaan for a reburial in Shechem. And Shechem had been a site where Abraham camped and built an altar. Shechem was a very important site in the stories of the patriarchs and on up into other events, even into the kingdom era in the Old Testament. Some of Stephen's remarks here seem a bit odd in terms of our understanding of the story of how things transpired in the Old Testament. Some of his remarks reflect the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. For example, Stephen here mentions 75 members of Jacob's family going into Egypt. But if you read in most English Bibles, you're going to read that it was 70 members, but that's because the Hebrew version counts the descendants of Jacob in one way, and the Greek version counts the descendants of Jacob in another way. There are four descendants of Joseph that live in Egypt that are not counted in the Hebrew version that are counted in the, four descendants of Jacob and Jacob himself who are counted in the Septuagint and are not counted in the Hebrew version. So there's a difference in the reckoning there, 70 or 75, depending on which of those versions you're reading. The members of Joseph's household being included or excluded, depending on which version you're reading. And some of the comments that Stephen makes here reflect knowledge that we don't have preserved for us biblically, such as his comment on the education of Moses that we'll be coming to shortly, or his comment about the divisions of Moses' life into 40 and 40 and 40. That's not actually found in the Old Testament. We know Moses was 80 years old when he went back to lead Israel out of Egypt, but we're not told that he was 40 years old at the time when he left Egypt to go to Midian. But Stephen says he was 40 years old. And there were resources available to the Jews. There was oral recollections that had been passed on through the generations. They had resources available that were lost with the temple. And Stephen was privy to some of that, aware of some of that. And these were things that I'm sure his hearers at that time would have found normal and had no particular issue with the facts as he recited them. But some of his comments also amount to intentional summaries or conflations regarding bringing things together in order to make the point that he wanted to make. Shechem, for example, had been a holy place for Abraham. Abraham had built an altar at Shechem and had offered sacrifices there under an oak tree in Shechem. And likewise, Jacob. Jacob had come to Shechem and had offered sacrifices there at Shechem. And in the days of Joshua, Joshua called together the people at Shechem in Joshua chapter 24, and that's the place where he renewed the covenant with Israel. And that's the place where he said, "Choose today whom you will serve, whether the gods of Egypt or the gods of your forefathers beyond the river or whoever, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." This happened at Shechem. So Shechem had been a very important location. It had been deeded to Joseph by Jacob in Genesis chapter 48, verse 22. And Joseph was eventually buried at Shechem after the Exodus. In Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, we're told that Shechem is where Joseph's bones were buried. He was the one patriarch that is specifically recorded as being buried at Shechem. Shechem is where, again, Joshua renewed the covenant. Shechem was also the first capital of Israel when the kingdom divided in the days of Rehoboam. Solomon's son Rehoboam was not able to keep the kingdom of Israel intact because of rebelliousness and pride and sin. The kingdom of Israel was divided in two. And the king of the northern kingdom was a man named Jeroboam. And Jeroboam set up his first kingdom. His first capital, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, was set up in Shechem. So Shechem had a very important role in the Old Testament. It was a counterpoint to Jerusalem in several important ways. And that continues to be true even into the New Testament era. When we have the story of Jesus talking to the woman at the well in John chapter 4, that's a village called Sychar, which is on the outskirts of Shechem. It's right by the ancient site of Shechem. The area of Sychar where Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman at the well, John chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, like Shechem, the old town, was at the foot of Mount Gerizim, where there had been a Samaritan temple. The woman at the well said to Jesus in John chapter 4, verses 19 and 20, "Our forefathers worshiped God on this mountain, but you Jews say he must be worshiped in Jerusalem." And Jesus said, "Well, the day is coming when people won't worship on this mountain or in Jerusalem, but rather in spirit and in truth, because God is spirit and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." But there had been a Samaritan temple there on Mount Gerizim up until about 100 BC. It had been built in the days of Nehemiah, about 440 BC, and had survived until about 100 BC when the Jewish priest king John Hyrcanus had led a war against the Samaritans and had conquered the Samaritans. And among the things that he did in subjugating the Samaritan people, he destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. That's what the woman at the well was referring to. Our fathers worship God on this mountain. That Samaritan temple had been destroyed by John Hyrcanus 100 years before Jesus was born. But the Samaritans still gathered there in that area around Shechem for their annual observance of Passover. And in fact, they still do that today. The Samaritans are a very, very small faith community today. But there's still a small group of Samaritans that go to Mount Gerizim every year to celebrate the Passover and slaughter lambs there in their observance of the Passover. So all of these connections to altars and worship at Shechem and Samaritan territory, those things would have been obvious to the Jewish rulers who were listening to Stephen. Those things would have, they knew their Old Testament, they knew their traditions, they knew about the Samaritans, they knew what Jeroboam had done. All of those things would have resonated with them as Stephen mentions Shechem. And they would have seen what you and I have to maybe research a little bit and struggle a little bit to see the connection between the idea of a holy place and Shechem. Because Shechem had on many occasions been considered a holy place, a place where God was worshipped, a place where godly people presented sacrifices and offerings to God, place where people came together in the name of the Lord to make decisions and so forth. So Stephen continues, Acts chapter 7, verses 17 through 22. But as the time of the promise drew near, which God had granted to Abraham, that is the promise of his people coming out of Egypt. As the time drew near, which God had granted to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose over Egypt another king who did not know Joseph. He dealt shrewdly with our race and forced our fathers to expose their infants so that they would not be kept alive. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. Again, some of the descriptive things that Stephen says here was in literature, Jewish literature that was available at the time when Stephen was speaking, but is not a part of our scriptures, not a part of the Old Testament canon, and not a part of what we have in recorded history at this time, except for the references that Stephen makes here. Stephen says in verse 17, the specific promise that God would bring his people out of servitude, out of bondage in Egypt, the time for that came close, the time of deliverance of Israel from Egypt and the possession of Canaan, into possession of Canaan as God had promised. In Genesis chapter 15, verses 14 and 18, God had told Abraham these things would happen. The 400 years went by. The time had approached for God to fulfill his promise. And again, this is a paradigm. When God makes long-range promises, as in you and your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed, it may take a long time, but God fulfills his promises. God does what he said. He fulfilled that promise to Abraham. Don't you think he would fulfill the promise of blessing through the seed? Of course he would. So Stephen described here the story of Moses, and he talks about Moses in three segments of 40 years each. His years as a son of Pharaoh's daughter living in Egypt, his years, 40 years shepherding in Midian, and then 40 years of leading Israel. Moses, he says, when he was an infant, when he was born, was beautiful in God's sight. And again, this reflects something other than a specific statement in the scriptures, but Moses' parents treasured him, did not want to expose him, did not want him to die, and so they protected him for 3 months before putting him out in the river in that little basket with the pitch that was to keep it afloat, and seeing to it that Moses had an opportunity to live. As Stephen was about to emphasize here, Moses was rejected by his own people. We have a theme running through here. Joseph was rejected by his brothers. Moses was rejected by his own people. Jesus was rejected by his people. Stephen is doing his utmost here to draw these connections, to call their attention to the fact that what's happening is in fulfillment of prophetic types and shadows. This has been the reaction of the people of God in other generations as well. The patriarchs, the Exodus generation, Moses was rejected by his own people. There's definitely an allusion here to God's choice of leaders versus man's choice. Men often choose badly. But God chose Joseph, and God chose Moses, and God chose Jesus, no matter what opinions men might have had or what desires men might have exercised. Now, Moses' background, he had a pagan education. Moses was given a pagan Egyptian education. He was well-versed, instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And wisdom there is a kind of double-edged, because there is wisdom about growing crops and managing kingdoms and a lot of things, but there also is the Egyptian wisdom of their pagan practices, of the gods that they worshiped, that God called them to account for. The pragmatism that said the Israelite people are a problem and we need to diminish their numbers by killing the infant boys. There were a lot of problems with the wisdom of Egypt, but Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. His background was not especially what one would imagine for a godly leader, a man who's going to lead the children of Israel and bring them into a covenant relationship with God and worship God at Sinai and so forth. His background, while he was well equipped for some things, mighty in word and deed in some ways, was not who the Jews would have expected to lead the nation and give them the divine law. What's this Egyptian doing trying to lead the nation and provide them with this divine leadership and the divine commandments? And so these problems were problems that Moses had to deal with, and before him Joseph had to deal with. And these problems anticipate the problems that Jesus had in communicating God's message to his own generation, a message that Stephen is determined to convey to the Sanhedrin here. Stephen is giving a defense, but it's not a defense of Stephen. It's a defense of the gospel and of the church. It's a defense of the assembly of those people who worship God in spirit and truth, not bound to the structure of the temple, not bound to the law of Moses, but definitely experiencing the fulfillment of the promises that God had made to Abraham, and that God had worked in part through Joseph and worked in part through Moses and finally worked in full through Jesus. And we're going to have to pause here once again, Acts chapter 7, verse 23, in the middle of Stephen's presentation. And in our next segment, we'll pick up as Stephen continues to talk about how God worked not merely through a temple and not merely in Jerusalem, but how God worked among his people, and the people often twisted in the wrong direction with valuing the works of their own hands beyond the work of God and the things that God would do with them and for them. And we'll see how this turns out. But ultimately, what Luke is reporting to us here is a successful defense of the gospel of Christ. Not that Stephen persuaded all of his hearers, but that he upheld the truth of the gospel using the Old Testament scriptures, speaking by the enlightenment provided by the Spirit of God. He stood his ground, he taught the truth, and he forced them to make a choice. Many of them made the wrong choice, but he forced them to make a choice: Jesus or not Jesus. And that's the choice everyone has to make.